Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. And next up on This Week in Law, I'm joined by Matt Curtis, Mike Keyes, and Evan Brown comes back to the show. We're going to talk about the latest developments, as we do, at the intersection of law and technology. What does it take to file a valid declaratory judgment in federal court? Does the taking of wireless data violate the Wiretapping Act? How will you exit your employment with your data intact? And we're going to take on The Girl on Wall Street. Is she a derivative work of The Bull on Wall Street? We think that's a bunch of bull. All this and more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 383, recorded April 21st, 2017. Bunch of bull. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We have a really fun and kind of retro show for you here today, and I'm in a really retro kind of mood. I hope you guys are, too. I'll explain throughout the show why we're feeling kind of retro, but one very obvious reason why we are is Evan Brown is joining us this week. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise, and glad I can fill, you know, a retro slot. You know, I guess that's a good thing, and never feel any younger. So glad to be here, and as always, looking forward to the conversation. Looking forward to getting caught up and talking about all these interesting things. So thanks for having me back.
It's wonderful to have you back. And you're only retro, not because you are aging, but because for anyone who has not been religiously following along with the show since its inception, Evan was a very, very long time co-host of the show. So wonderful to see you again. Evan's been way too long. And co-host Mike Keyes is here as well. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be here and great to be with Evan as well.
It is, isn't it? It's great to see you, Mike. We were dark last week. Hope you had a good one.
Had a great one. Yes, very good. Productive couple of weeks.
Good, good. And Matt Curtis, our intern and co-host, is running a little late. We're hoping to get him on the show. We're just monitoring Skype, and we'll add him on when he's done. And he's been working on an intern.
He's an intern. He's bringing coffee, right? That's it. That's
why. Yeah.
Had to stop at Starbucks for us. Thanks.
Yes, he's got a big cardboard tray he'll bring in with him for all of us, I hope. He's working on something interesting. He's involved in a competition, he told me, at school. So hopefully we can get him to elaborate on that when we get him on, because it sounded fascinating and there's an IP and technology angle to it. So hopefully we can get him on and get some more details on that. In the meantime, I told you we were going to be throwing it back a bit during the show. We're going to throw it back to 1989, a work of art from 1989, and discuss why it's in the headlines today. And that's a copyright issue. So I'm assuming that people have, at least peripherally in their news feeds, seen that there's been some controversy and news about the Charging Bull statue that resides in front of the New York Stock Exchange in New York. Now, I really didn't know the history of that statue or how long it had been there until all this controversy arose. So for anybody who is in what was my boat about this, we'll fill you in. That bronze statue was made by sculptor Arturo Di Mocca. He apparently, according to the Washington Post, spent 2 years and $300,000 making the thing, and without asking anybody's permission, in 1989, deposited it on Wall Street. I believe it's been moved to its current location down at the bottom of Wall Street. I visited it for the first time over the summer. And as anyone who visits it will tell you, it is sadly, and sort of realistically, I guess, photographed quite often from, probably just as often from its rear angle as it is from its forward angle. And if you ever visit the statue, you will find out exactly what I'm talking about. That is not what we're bringing it up for today.
Right,
what we're bringing
it
up
for. Of course,
you had to
mention that. Yes? It had absolutely nothing to do with it, but there you go.
Okay, well, anyway. You know, it's all part of the work of art and the message of the art, right? Which is something that the sculptor Arturo Di Mocca is making a big deal about at the moment, because not too long ago, right before International Women's Day, on the eve of International Women's Day, a hedge fund manager in New York deposited another bronze statue right by the bull, a small girl in high top sneakers and a swirling skirt. And people have started calling her, or maybe the people who put her there started calling her, the fearless girl. And she is facing off against the front side, thankfully, of the bull on Wall Street. And she has gotten her share of commentary and criticism just because of the statement that she is making, or that people are reading into her making. Apparently there's some controversy swirling around her swirling skirt and hair about the commercial aspect of her, that she was perhaps placed there just to help the hedge fund promote a fund that was about women-owned companies. But be that as it may, she's clearly a work of art. She is commentating, or appears to be commentating, on the bull itself and everything that it stands for. And the other hoof has dropped, as it were, in that sculptor Arturo Di Mocca has decided that there are copyright and trademark issues about all of this, that she creates an unauthorized derivative work of his sculpture and various and sundry other loosely IP-related arguments that the sculptor and his attorneys have put into a letter to the city of New York. The city of New York does not seem inclined to bow to these demands, so we'll have to see what happens here. Mayor de Blasio has put his own fists on his hips and tweeted various things, and also said that the bull will stay. What he's tweeted is, "Men who don't like women taking up space are exactly why we need the fearless girl." So lot of controversy around all of this, and a lot of IP issues that are coming up as well. So Evan, I knew you'd love this story, and wanted to get your take on it.
It is really interesting because it's a creative argument. Well, I'm focusing on the one that sounds the most plausible. I'm not really evaluating the strength of any of those claims, because I, you know, right off the bat, I think the trademark claims are really, really weak. I don't see where there's a likelihood of confusion or any kind of real trademark ownership to begin with. But so the essential issue that the artist is making here is that by placing this little girl, the statue of the little girl, in conjunction with the pre-existing work, that there has been a derivative work created. And, and it's easy in situations like this where there are social issues obviously being made, maybe even quasi-political issues being made here, economic issues, a whole variety of sociological phenomena are at play here. It's really easy to jump to a conclusion as to what the merits of a legal claim might be that sounds in copyright. So if we're going to be wise about it and be rational, let's look at what a derivative work is under the Copyright Act. And it's a pretty long definition. I won't read every word of it, but it's in Section 101 of the Copyright Act, if anybody wants to look it up, 17 U.S.C. 101. And a derivative work is a work that's based upon one or more pre-existing works. And then it gives a long list of examples, such as translations, musical arrangements, etc. And then it says that it is any other work which may be recast, transformed, or adapted. So the question becomes, you know, is placing this statue of a little girl next to the statue of the bull doing any of those things? Is it based upon that pre-existing work? I don't think so, really. But does it recast it, transform, or adapt it? I think that's where you can probably make a decent argument that it does recast the overall message, the overall artistic merit, or overall artistic currency, we'll say, of that. But whether it gets to the point that it really is a new work that has been created, I think that's where the argument that it's a derivative work ultimately fails, because a derivative work at the very beginning of the analysis has to be a work, a new work that has been created here. And I think that a court would likely find that in this situation that there are two works here, and that, you know, putting them in conjunction together is interesting. It may change the overall message, but my feeling is, from the copyright standpoint, that this probably is not a winning argument, that it's a derivative work that's been created by the placing of these two statues in conjunction with one another. But it's certainly an interesting analysis to go through, because it stretches and really brings in new contours and new flavors to the derivative work argument. What do you two think?
Mike, I'll let you go first, because I want to get your take too on the trademark issues.
Yeah. So, one, I love the sculpture. I think it's really cool. It's absolutely iconic. Now, with all due respect to Mr. Brown, who I have tremendous amounts of respect for, I think this is an absurd copyright infringement claim. I also think it's an absurd dilution claim too. And primarily for one reason: when it comes to creation of a derivative work, by definition, and Evan had just read a portion of the definition from Section 101, you need to incorporate the pre-existing work. I'm not aware of, maybe there's some case law to support this, but I'm not aware of any case where there was a derivative work that was found without producing a copy of the underlying work in some form or fashion. Here, there's been no copy of the bowl made. It's simply placement of another sculptural work beside it. Now, if you take this to its logical conclusion in terms of the infringement aspect, this being a derivative work, if I go and stand next to the bull, I've created a derivative work. It just doesn't make any sense. I haven't copied the bull. I'm just standing next to it, much like the fearless girl is. So I think these copyright claims are DOA, at least in terms of the derivative work. I also think there's also a VARA claim. A Visual Artists Rights Act claim. I also think that's probably dead too, because, as you pointed out, Denise, this sculpture was created in 1989, and VARA is only effective for works created after the enactment of that act, which is in 1990. So I don't think that there's a VARA claim here to speak of as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting stew of copyright issues to consider, because if this is a derivative work, then so I guess are all those photos that people go and take with the thing from whatever angle they choose. And I guess the artist has in the past taken some enforcement actions against others. Somebody tried to put it on a book cover, various right. things. So commercial uses of photographs of the bull he has tried to enforce. Now, once again, I don't think anybody's taken that to court and argued the issues, so we don't really know if he's gotten people to back down. He's just simply gotten them to back down. We don't know how the legal merits would have come out.
And in those instances, that's far more meritorious, because that's where copies of the bull have been made and reproduced, mm-hmm. either for right. commercial reproduction or otherwise. So a copy was made. That would be a violation of the exclusive right under an author under Section 106. So there, I think that would be a perfectly legitimate claim to stop somebody from making a copy and reproducing it for commercial gain or otherwise, potentially. But here, when you're not creating an actual copy, you just place something next to it. I don't know. I just don't see it at all.
The other thing that is an interesting point, but I don't think has any legal bearing. We have a couple of write-ups in our rundown on this that we have available for you to read at your leisure. If you'd like, you can go to our Flipboard page, or you can go to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. We are episode 383, and you'll see all the material we've looked at in advance of the show. One of the pieces is at the Alt, and it's by Paul C. Rapp. And one of his points has to do with the fact that the original artist here, Arturo Di Mocha, never asked for permission to put the bull where it is. And so when someone else comes along and does something similar in similar space, he really has no hoof to stand on. Sorry, I'll stop doing that. But what Mr. Rapp says is copyright infringement, please. You dropped your art on the street and now you're complaining? Bite me. I don't know if that would hold up in court, but I'd love to see a judge put something like that in an opinion. And I'm wondering if you feel like there's any sort of estoppel, which is a legal principle that's, or unclean hands, another equitable legal principle that says if you've gone ahead and done something or benefited something from something, you can't then come along and complain that somebody else is doing the same thing and now you get to stop them. Do you think the bite me argument holds any water, Evan?
Well, I mean, it's clever, right? And it's clever that he used so much of the word the term that the letters BS stands for, haha, right? You know, you can put that through the article. So, I mean, I don't think, you know, you'd need to go there to have like this abandonment or estoppel argument or whatever you'd want to characterize it as to defeat a copyright claim on this, because I don't know that that is a real sound argument, because there actually is, I mean, there's this principle that's codified in the Copyright Act that the ownership of the copyright is separate from the ownership of the material object. So just because he abandoned the physical copy of a work doesn't mean that he's forfeited or somehow donated his copyright rights to the public domain. So, you know, I just don't think that's helpful. I don't think that you would need to make that argument in order to be successful in defeating a copyright claim here. But I recognize there's some other aspects of that argument too, you know, sort of like equitable notion of how can you make an argument that it's somehow being recast in a way that's unauthorized if you were the one who put it out there in a way that sort of took great liberties and exercised great freedoms, and how it was going to be cast in the first sense. So I just want, Michael, I just wanted to address, you know, the point that you made about you know, the no derivative work, you know, not being considered a derivative work if no copy was made. And I like mm-hmm. that I like that analysis. I think that's a valid point. I would just, you know, if you and I were collaborating, writing the brief together, I would say let's not push that too hard, because we don't want to try to tell the court that we're reading something into the definition of a derivative work that's not there. You know, it doesn't say that a derivative work is a copy of the original work that's all there. But I think analytically we're trying to arrive at the same place, is that, you know, what is the result here is not a new work. It's just two statues that happen to be right next to one another. And clearly there is no copy of the one being made. And so it's just at the end, it just sort of dissolves into nothingness, this whole idea that it is a derivative work. So just to comment on that, I think we're probably talking about the same thing in articulating it in slightly different ways. And I guess the third point I'd want to make is, you know, I'm just a sensible Midwestern guy. I'll try to work up my sense of righteous indignation and say that, oh, this is absurd, and DOA and all that stuff. Next time I'll try better to make clear that it's absurd right off the bat, okay? Fine.
I think there is a flavor.
No, I,
Go ahead, Mike.
I hope Evan was not in any way offended by my my comments on the case.
So
I do think it's I will grant that I think it's a clever, creative argument. I just don't think that there's any support in the law for it. But you know, that's how new law is made. You know, somebody coming up with some sort of clever argument. I just don't think it's going anywhere.
Yep.
And I do think that there is some sort of legal hay that could be made. Oh God, do bulls eat hay? From the from the bite me argument, because it's you, Evan. You come on the show and I start punning uncontrollably. It's like a reaction. I don't know what it is.
I'm breaking out in puns. I haven't even brought up the fact that in your setting up of the narrative, you mentioned that the statue was moved.
It was indeed. And that surrounded the point that I wanted to make on the you dropped your art on the street and now you're complaining bite me argument. And that is that at some level, where these things are and the fact that they exist in the middle of a sidewalk in the city of New York is the province of the city of New York to decide. It's almost like, you know, it has the sole discretion over making its streets and sidewalks into art galleries. And if it wants to display one work next to another work that it decided, you know, someone had dropped there and it decided could stay, then it gets to decide the next one can stay too. And that should be the end of the story. Do you agree?
Yeah, you were talking to me, right? Both of you. Right. Yeah. You know, I was thinking of trying to make a dilemma, the two horns of the dilemma, seeing how we can put this issue out to pasture. Yeah, it's going to be, there is something about, you know, the sort of the public space of all this. I mean, it's, and doesn't that get to the whole issue of, you know, you put it out there and, you know, it's sort of, there's not much of a claim you can make on it, right? You know, just putting it in the hands of the city that way. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah, I kind of think that the trademark. Well, first of all, I think Mike could pretty much knock out all the trademark arguments in his sleep, and maybe we should have him explain that in more detail why it's not a trademark infringement. But secondly, you know, since we're working through this issue of whether it's next to something and it hasn't made a copy, does that give rights to any sort of copyright claim? If we come down negatively on that issue, then I think that, you know, the city gets to decide where it's putting all bronze works of art that get dropped on its sidewalks, just like it decides how long the trash is going to stay there. Hey, I understand that Matt Curtis has been able to join us. Hi, Matt. Wanted to welcome you on.
Hi. Sorry for being late. Had a little conflict that came up, so thanks for letting me join.
We want to hear about your little conflict if you're comfortable discussing that on the show.
Yeah, so I'm part of a business team here at Notre Dame, and we are an early stage cancer diagnostic company. One of our biological sciences chair here at Notre Dame, Krislyn D'Souza Shorey, did research on microvesicles, and basically, I'm not a scientist, so I think of it as like dandruff comes out of your hair like microvesicles come out of proteins when there is cancer. And so she has tracked down and she has a patent for detecting six cancers using this microvesicle. Some of you may know about the tracking of this. It's similar to tracking exosomes. There's been a lot of movement in the market for that. She thinks that microvesicles are at least as good, if not a better way to go. So we just got done pitching with that, and we'll see how it goes. I'll find out after the show.
Good. That sounds really exciting. Keep us posted. Much more high level than what we're discussing, I think, which is we're devolving into puns and hilarity about the Bull on Wall Street statue and the IP claims related to it. And if you have any thoughts on it, we'll get them from you in just a moment here. But before I lose my train of thought too badly, we were talking about the trademark claims that this guy wants to assert again, pointed out in this article at The Alt, artist has apparently applied for trademarks, the trademark Charging Bull New York, for a whole range of products, so that he might be able to conceivably down the road put his own image of the bull sculpture he made on things like preserves, salads, meats, fish products, olive oils, chocolates, pastas, pasta sauces, rice, honey, breakfast cereals, and wine. So you can make your own market evaluations as to whether you would buy wine branded with the Wall Street Bull. But does anything that the girl, anything to do with the girl statute, prevent him from being able to, whether wisely or otherwise, pursue such a business strategy, Mike?
Well, let me say this. I am not at all bullish on the trademark claims. Okay.
Right.
I'm about as bullish on the trademark claims as I am the copyright claims. I don't see that there's any trademark infringement or any trademark dilution, as mm-hmm. has been alleged here. Of course, in order for there to be a trademark claim or a trademark dilution claim, there would have to be the use of this girl in some way as a source identifying, as a source identifying thing. So the girl is just there. She's a sculpture. She's not being used to promote a competitive product or service. She's not being there to in any way signify that she comes from a particular source, as I understand it. There may be a little placard or something there that gives her a name or title or something. And maybe the name of the hedge fund is there. But I don't see that this is in any sense of the term a trademark use in any sense. There's just not competing. They're not promoting a product or service here.
Got it. So, Matt, I don't know if you've had the chance to take a look at this dispute about the IP issues being asserted by the sculptor who made the Bull on Wall Street sculpture. But if you have, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I certainly have a much lower level understanding than Mike has. I looked at it. I'm sure you guys already discussed this, but the copyright, the claim that it's a derivative work, I don't know what the limit of derivative works are, but it just seems like a really, really expansive one. This kind of goes back to it's kind of like a dead hand problem in other forms of law, but this is an extremely dead hand problem if we're going to expand derivative works that way. I hope this doesn't go anywhere.
We all thought it was a derivative work. What are you talking about?
It's clear.
It's clearly a derivative.
That's why I'm a 1L, right?
They're teaching you at Notre Dame. Gosh, I thought Notre Dame. Anyway, all right, go on. Sorry,
you're dead on, Matt. Don't let Evan dissuade you.
You're dead on with your dead hand analogy. Explain what that is for people who haven't been to law school, please.
The dead hand analogy typically arises kind of in constitutional claims, where we're talking about. When we put in a law, specifically when you're talking about making constitutional amendments, you have to get just the process is immense. It's 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the states, and therefore anything that you make a constitutional claim has an immense effect that is really hard to change. I think there's been one ruling, and I can't remember which one amendment, which has overturned a Supreme Court ruling. I think that's the 13th Amendment. There may be others, but off the top of my head, I think it's that one. So. In terms of the derivative work problem is less, but if we're expanding copyright to 90-100 years as it's being expanded, then any work that's being done and then plausibly talking about it, not even commenting on it because there's an exclusion for that, but any work that's taking the theme or taking the embodying it, that's a smaller example of the dead hand problem.
Are you guys thinking what I'm thinking? That all sounds perfectly well and good and reasonable, but I was thinking of the rule against perpetuities.
No, I was thinking about how when you fall asleep on your arm and wake up and it's like you think there's somebody else's hand there.
It's all the same, yes. I think it's all the same concept that for policy reasons you don't want long deceased thinkers making current real world policy or decisions. So that would be the dead hand problem in a nutshell. I think that we've already got ourselves a really good MCLE passphrase to put in the first part of the show here. We put these in the show for those of you who may be listening for professional credit in your field. And I'm sure that's the primary reason why anybody comes along to this show. But we do talk about a lot of interesting cutting edge legal issues with very knowledgeable folks. So we make it available if you're a lawyer in particular, or perhaps there are other fields where this might apply, where you could listen to this show and possibly get professional credit. We put these phrases in case you're doing that and you need to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show. If you're a lawyer, you can head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv, find the This Week in Law page there, and there's information about how you can go about submitting in your jurisdiction in the United States. Our first phrase for this show is a run of bovine puns. We'll try and come up with one that lives up to that somewhat later in the show as well. I think I've about had enough of the bull. How about you guys? Anything to add before we move on? Mike?
I've heard enough.
I am ready for you to, I'm ready for you to steer this conversation elsewhere.
Matt,
I'm just going to hand it off to these guys.
Yep, I think you can't outdo those puns.
Yeah,
all right.
You really stepped in it.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, so we're going to move from some specifically copyright and trademark related issues to some more entertainment related issues related to films and music and the like. All right. I don't know what puns we can make out of the Fate of the Furious movie, but we will see. Yeah, I'm sure they will come fast and furious before too long.
That's good.
What? Sorry, go ahead.
I just said that was a good pun already.
Ah, thank you. Again, in my theme of this being sort of a retro show, I didn't know this was happening much anymore, but apparently in Maryland, at least, it is. We have a couple of suspects who wandered into their local movie theater with cell phones strapped in on harnesses to their chests and attempted to film and pirate from the theater the Fate of the Furious movie. They are going to be facing potentially under Maryland state law a year in jail and a $2,500 fine. Of course, there are various federal copyright laws that also could come into play here if any federal prosecutor wanted to come after them. But they, Anne Arundel County Police apparently have this well in hand under state law. And I really just bring it up because who knew that people were still camcording? I mean, camcorders don't even exist anymore, really, or not in the way that they did when these laws first were enacted anyway. People are still camcording movies and pirating them that way. Who knew? Evan, did you know?
No, but it comes as no surprise. I mean, think about it. We're all carrying around. I mean, a lot of us can record in 4K. Just with the device we're carrying. So, you know, it comes as no surprise that it's still happening. It just seems like with, it seems like there would be other ways of getting the content. This seems like it would be an outmoded way of getting the content to pirate. It seems like there would be other ways, but I guess it's still happening. I don't think of it a lot in my everyday life going and doing this stuff. So I'm admittedly not up on the modern techniques of at least this part of piracy, right? So
yeah, the only time I ever see a camera strapped to someone on their chest is when they're out with a GoPro trying to capture whatever extreme stunt they're engaged in. And I guess these guys decided, hey, we could use this for other purposes. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, maybe they thought, you know, this technology is so antiquated, no one's going to know what they're doing. No one will suspect them of doing anything wrong. But, you know, this is potential criminal copyright infringement. As you mentioned, Denise, there's penalties under the federal statute. And apparently a wide array of states also have similar types of laws on the books. So can't do it with camcorder or with a smartphone. Not advisable. Right.
If you go through this Ars Technica piece by David Kravitz detailing what happened here, they report that there was an investigator that had been watching these quote unquote two known piracy suspects. So apparently they were, and this is not their first, at least suspicious act or allegedly problematic act. So it sounds like they had actually been following them and thinking, hey, maybe they'll walk into this theater and try and record it and we can catch them. And it appears they drove fastly and furiously right into that trap. Matt, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that they're largely unsympathetic as individuals who've created this. I do think it's problematic, though, that clearly the industry is using these state laws to enforce copyright when really – it seems like it should be enforced by the federal copyright, and to criminalize this to me just seems over the top, and that they're watching it means that they've incentivized this, and this is, I don't know how often this happens, but it just seems like a really harsh penalty.
It does, a year in jail for having done this. Now again, apparently they'd had other activity that at least put them on police radar, but they hadn't. Doesn't sound like been charged with that. At least it doesn't sound like that from the report that we're seeing here. I'd have to agree with you that a year in jail, you know, the $2,500 fine would probably be a sufficient penalty. But the state of Maryland thinks otherwise, and perhaps has been lobbied by business interests that think otherwise in order to enact this law. Similarly, in Nigeria. Another sort of throwback concept for me, because I really haven't heard from any Nigerian princes in a very, very, very long time.
Because you never collected your $30 million fortunes that they had waiting for you.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've got it all waiting. You know, it's really my retirement fund, Mike. I'm saving it for when it's more desperately needed. Apparently there are enough people in the world that desperately need to pirate movies that file sharing is still happening. It is still happening, you know, torrenting, etc. It is still happening in Nigeria. But if you're engaged in it in Nigeria, once again, you might find that the fines and penalties are a bit on the stiff side. There were at least two, right? How many people were involved here? I felt like there might have been more. 18 individuals in front of a court in Nigeria last week. This is reported by Andy at Torrent Freak, who were... file sharing a locally produced film, and the authorities got involved. In fact, Nigeria's censorship board got involved and decided to prosecute this. They fairly tightly control, it sounds like, what people may or may not watch and consume in the country. And apparently their authority is broad enough to also control whether or not they are taking media and sharing it in an unauthorized, copyright infringing sort of way. So these 18 individuals got 45 days in jail and a fine of what would equate to about $40 US apiece. So the point of Andy over at Torrent Freak, who wrote this up, is exactly the point that Matt was just making, that, you know, most nations and states that regulate these kinds of activities think fines are plenty of a sufficient deterrent, except in very extreme circumstances. As Mike was pointing out, we do have criminal copyright infringement in the United States. But apparently they do have it in Nigeria. And here's one instance where they decided to enforce it. Mike, did you take a look at this?
I did briefly. Yeah, I'm very, very harsh. I mean, it sounds like really what's at issue here is less about the copyright infringement aspect of this, but more about government censorship. Mm-hmm. Sounds like it, that they're really trying to clamp down and censor speech and expression, and are doing this in a very heavy-handed, draconian way.
Yeah, I think that's the point that Andy at Torrent Freak was trying to get across. Matt, again, to your point of jail time for infringement being the exception rather than the rule, I don't think we can probably discern a pattern from a court in Nigeria and its state censorship board and a court in Maryland deciding that criminal penalties were in order for infringing activities. But who knows? I mean, do you think we're seeing sort of a shift of tide? There was a time when the entertainment industry was coming down on individuals so harshly that they were in a real bad PR situation. And do you think we're shifting away from that to where criminal prosecution of things like this might be more publicly palatable?
Yeah, I think that there's a bit of mission creep in a larger context. Like when you look at the original theory of police power, it was for the health and welfare of society. And, you know, copyrights was something that was different than that. That they're being put inside of the general police power, which is what they would have to be for state law right now, especially to make them felonies. As strict liability crimes that you know, it doesn't require a mens rea, it doesn't require, and if we get rid of a lot of the procedural things, it seems like it's outside of any traditional view of what a police power would be, especially for a felony. I don't think it's for the same reasons as Nigeria. I think Mike hit it on the head there I think that's largely just a population control of information, which I just think is sad. I'm As much as we don't like the things we're doing in our country, I like that we don't have censorship to that degree.
Hear, hear. Evan, any thoughts?
Just to, you know, make it the third string in the chord here, that it seems like the Nigerian thing was more ideological and political than having to do with the intellectual property enforcement. So mm-hmm. Other than that, I think these gentlemen have articulated it very well, and I commend them.
All right. Let us move on to another entertainment industry related story. This time a blog post from the TMCA authored by Mike Keyes. We've got him right here. Mike, you had an interesting post about BMG and how you go about bringing what's called a declaratory judgment action, right? That's what you were referring to in your post, DJ action.
Right.
Which is basically a declaration of the party's rights before a dispute has actually arisen. And that can get a little thorny. You might find yourself, it's good to go in and get court guidance before things go terribly wrong, but there's a balance you have to strike there. Courts want to see that things might actually go terribly wrong and that it's not too early for the court to jump in. What should the plaintiff have done differently here?
Yes. Yeah, so just you're exactly right. There's this mechanism that we have in federal court practice called a declaratory judgment action. And it's used a lot in cases where a rights holder, a copyright holder, a trademark or patent holder alleges an act of infringement against a defendant. And if the defendant believes that he or she or it is not doing anything wrong, it can actually initiate a federal lawsuit to have the court declare that they're not doing anything wrong. But the key is there's got to be an actual what's called case in controversy in order for there to be federal court jurisdiction. So this case that we blogged about is a very typical type of situation that we've seen over the years involving a copyright holder, that would be BMG, that owns a lot of copyrights with respect to music, and the ISP, which the name of the ISP is escaping me, even though I just wrote this a couple of days ago. But in any event,
Windstream Services.
There we go. Thank you. Yes. Windstream. So BMG BMG had contacted Windstream about all of the alleged infringement that was taking place on the Windstream system as a result of all these ISP subscribers, and had sent a demand letter saying there are millions of instances of infringement, but didn't necessarily point to a specific act of infringement by any of the subscribers or point to an act of infringement that would make Windstream liable for an act of copyright infringement. So Windstream used this declaratory judgment action process that I had just mentioned to initiate a lawsuit against BMG, asking the court to declare that it's not doing anything wrong. And what the court ultimately said is, look, what you're really asking for here is an advisory opinion, Windstream, as to the legitimacy of your business model. And, you know, federal courts are not in the business of providing advisory opinions. We only provide guidance and adjudicate actual disputes. And in this case, there wasn't reference to a specific copyright. There wasn't even an allegation with respect to a specific act of infringement. And so until you have more, you know, you guys go elsewhere. Federal court is not the place for you to litigate this particular dispute. So interesting. Right. It was interesting to me in that, you know, the demand letter was pretty specific. Well, it was certainly specific in terms of alleging acts of infringement, millions of acts of infringement. So on the surface, you would think, of course, there's a dispute here between the parties that a federal court could adjudicate. But the federal court said not specific enough.
Great. Thank you for explaining that for us and giving that tip to plaintiffs in federal declaratory judgment actions. There's another piece that we have in our rundown from way back at the beginning of the year that I've been sort of wanting to toss out and have some discussion of or just some monitoring of, and it's music industry cases to watch in this year that was written up at Forbes, various and sundry of them, what we can expect from disputes on the radar of Eric Jacobson, who wrote this piece. So Mike, since you're our follower of, most ardent follower, I would have to say, of things musical on the show, I'm just wondering if you've been, looking at any of these cases that were detailed here and, think any of them are particularly interesting or things that we should pay attention to as the year continues to unfold.
Well, there were a couple of cases referenced in the article that are on appeal. There's the case involving Robin Thicke. And is it Robin or Alan? I always get confused between him and
the
dad.
It's Robin.
Okay.
Alan's
right.
The
I grew
actor.
Up with Alan Thicke. That's right.
The late
this is
Alan
his son.
Thicke.
The late Alan Thicke. So yes. his son, Robin, with the Blurred Lines song that came out a few years ago. Of course, there was the jury verdict against him and his producer, and a sizable jury verdict, multi-million-dollar jury verdict. It has been appealed to the Ninth Circuit. One of the key issues in the case is what the jury should have heard. Should the jury have heard the sound recording, or should it have just have heard the sheet music rendition of the song at issue? So that's an important case. I think it'll be interesting to see which way the Ninth Circuit comes down. It'll provide a lot of guidance and I think clarity on a going forward basis. Similar to that is the Stairway to Heaven case that we've talked about before. Similar issue mm-hmm. that's raised in that case as well. And that's a little further down the line in terms of the appellate process. I think the Robin Thicke case is more teed up for a decision. But those are two of the interesting ones that I think are going to be important and fun to watch.
Hey, Denise, did we play Ali Spagnola's cover of Blurred Lines when she was on the show one of those times? Or
I just wanted to make sure you
were aware of it and that everybody listening was aware of it because it's really fun.
Yes. If we neglected to play it, it is out there. You should definitely bring it up and listen.
Alan, Evan, are you speaking of the mashup that munges them both together?
No, it's a cover that Ali Spagnola did. She was a guest on the show at least once before. So real talented. Yeah. She's well known for, what was it, The Hour of Power, Denise? Or it was like that 60-minute
song. Yes, yes.
I think we had her on because of the trademark stuff. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We did have her on because of trademark stuff. She had a, I think it was a shot glass or something that she.
Is that, and then the whole trademark dispute was over the hour of power mm-hmm. or whatever, you know, she had an album that had 61 minute songs on it, right?
Yes. Exactly.
There was another trademark. Okay. But anyway, but that has nothing to do with it. She did a cover of Blurred Lines, which is really entertaining.
Yes, we should have her back on the show. It's been too long. She's always entertaining and outspoken. And she did the other video, if you are not familiar with Ali, is the one that prompted us to have her on the show that was about that trademark dispute where she did a music video of herself in a courtroom describing how the trademark dispute should most definitely come out in her favor. A creative way to advocate for yourself in a legal dispute. What I wanted to ask about these, you know, sound-alike song cases that we discuss on the show from time to time and that continue to be brought up and litigated is, you know, ask all of you, if you think that there's been any sort of trend or anything we can say definitively is happening with these vis-a-vis copyright law, it seems as though courts are still sympathetic to them, that they are complicated enough that they can confuse courts. And that if you are a creator and you come up with something that whether consciously or subconsciously sounds like another song, this is a real hazard in the music industry because it's sort of like a landmine out there that can come along and explode loudly in your face. Do you agree, Evan?
I don't have much or enough visibility into it to recognize any trends other than to say that, you know, music copyright, a couple things, I guess, music copyright issues when it comes to the infringement of songs, there's a long and rich tradition of that. I sort of think of the fountainhead of this whole issue, although I'm sure there were many, many cases prior to this, was the George Harrison, Chiffons dispute over He's So Fine versus My Sweet Lord. You know, I think that was in the mid-70s when that decision came out. So, you know, there certainly is a long tradition of these things. And I've been involved in some matters myself. A couple of firms ago, we were defense to, actually our firm represented Fergie. The Black Eyed Peas got sued over... it was a Boom Boom Pow. And, you know, there was just some real, the facts are so complicated. The science is very complicated. Musicology and, you know, doing all these comparisons. And, you know, I have a decent understanding of how to read sheet music. And this blew me away, you know, because it's like orders of magnitude more complex than just what's on the sheet. And I'm sure Mike, you know, can chime in on some of the complexity behind the science of all this. So with that, you know, makes me think that there's certainly going to be situations, plenty of situations where the process of making music becomes more complex and sophisticated, and musicians can draw on broader ranges of sources now to bring in styles and samples and what have you. So I think that if anything, things are only getting more complex. Just sometime last week, I think it was, saw on Reddit. It was like the post on Reddit was like every noise at once or every sound at once. There was this page you can go to, real Ajax-y kind of interface, where you can, you know, like there's every imaginable style of music and you can click on it and it will play you a little sample of that style of music. So that's just one illustration of how broad-ranged one's influence can be, or the influences on a musician can be these days. So there's it's crazy to think that it's going to get simpler. Only more complex and nuanced.
You agree with that, Mike?
I do. I think we're seeing some pretty interesting developments in this area. I mean, I think we've seen an uptick in claims. There's been a recent case that was filed, and I think we've talked about it before, against Justin Bieber over alleged copying of Four Notes. I think the Stairway to Heaven case was really interesting. There was some evidence in that case that that particular riff. But we had Joe Bennett on the show, as a matter of fact, a few months ago, and he was explaining for us, you know, that chromatic five-note phrase. You could trace that back into the 1700s, 1600s music from Europe. So it is complex. And, you know, something that I have always felt that our copyright law doesn't do a good enough job with is the music art form itself. And you can look back into the history of it. And I've gone on my soapbox about this before, but you know, there's always been a very extensive borrowing culture in music. I mean, look at the masters, Beethoven, Mozart, Bach. I mean, it was all about taking, not all about, but to a large extent, they would take each other's themes and variations and build on those. And so that's something that's just pervasive to the art form. Take jazz, for example. I mean, that's all about taking pre-existing works and manipulating them and changing and adding. It's just part of it's just how it goes. So I've always felt that our copyright laws aren't sensitive enough to the artistic realities of the situation. But we are going to see some cases, as I mentioned, the ones that are pending in the Ninth Circuit that I think will be give us some nice guidance on at least one aspect of these very complicated cases.
Great. Well, we will continue to monitor. Matt, do you have any thoughts before we move on?
I'm really scribbling notes from your guys' wisdom, so I'm gonna defer to you guys on this one.
All righty. Let us move on then to a really timely privacy case that relates to a lot of other issues that we've been talking about lately on the show. It's a taco suit, Evan. It's a class action.
Oh, there we go.
It's in your neck of the woods. It's in Chicago.
Yep.
It's a proposed class action. The way those things work is the plaintiffs hope to pursue a class action, and the court gets to have final say over whether that happens or not, whether you can have one representative plaintiff representing a really large class of similarly injured defendants out there. And the proposed class in this case, who would benefit from this case along with the plaintiff who filed the lawsuit, whose name is Kyle Zack, would be owners of Bose headphones, because apparently Zack and his lawyers discovered that Bose collects information about what's being done with those headphones and matches it up with the customer's personally identifiable serial number, and then, so the complaint says, sends the information to third parties, including a data miner named Segment.io. So is any of this sounding familiar to all of the discussion that we've been having about ISPs and having Tanya Forsythe on the show, our previous show, and how one of the things that, and she is a privacy lawyer, if you missed our last show, one of the things she mentioned on that show is how she's very careful with her own clients to counsel them to be cautious about saying, oh, we never use anything that's personally identifiable about you and give that to third parties like advertisers, because various things, as we're beginning to know, as the technology improves and people's searching and data mining abilities improve, can be personally identifiable with you, aside from your name and your phone number and your email address and various obvious things. Here's a serial number. Could be identified with a consumer if, you know, the record of that sale and credit card transaction, et cetera, is kept. So I think they've got a colorable claim that they're matching up activity data with personally identifiable data and sending it along to third parties without necessarily having the consumer's consent. Now, I haven't read the complaint. I haven't certainly delved into the Bose terms of service to see if any of this is disclosed, but it's sounding to me just at first blush like consumers are not certainly opting into this kind of treatment of their usage data of the Bose headphones. And I'm wondering, you know, the Bose headphone company is not an ISP. It is not governed under the Telecommunications Act. So things are going to be a little bit different regulatorily for it. But certainly companies like this, you know, any Internet of Things connected device is going to have to think through, what are we doing with data and what are we telling consumers that we're doing with the data, and what sort of agreement do we have with them about these actions, if any? So I'm guessing that this lawsuit exists because maybe not all of that was thought through as well as it could have been. Evan, have you looked at this at all?
I've just read the article. I haven't read the complaint, so I've got to mm-hmm. preface and, you know, give that caveat.
Right.
You know, the everything you're saying, I think, is probably the most pragmatic, is a list of the most pragmatic issues that a business should be thinking about in doing these things. Whether you're a hardware manufacturer, I guess the headphones are hardware, right? You know, mm-hmm. of devices and things, or providing some kind of online service where you're tracking user behavior, you know, software as a service or some kind of platform or what have you. Because the thing here is matching up the way that you're using the information you're collecting with what the expectations are on how that is to be gathered. And clearly there's this wonderful convenience that comes to the user from this. Like, for example, I learned about concerts in the upcoming area based on my Spotify, not even playlist, but just songs that I'd happen to listen to, you know, look up as a one-off on Spotify. So, mm-hmm. You know, there's the great convenience, there's the great trade-off on this. So that's one, factor in all this. Another factor, I think, is the substantive Wiretap Act. I guess it's a Wiretap Act case here. It sounds like, you know, of intercepting and sending off these communications. I guess it's between the player and the headphones. Is that where the communications are? There's the substantive issue under the Wiretap Act of whether or not that content that's being intercepted and shared is something that would not fall under the protected subject matter of the wiretap if it's just mere metadata, you know, song title and track and all that stuff. And then the third, factor or, you know, gravitational force at play here is, you know, the role of the class action lawsuit and all this. You know, you know that I've often been spoken sort of harshly about the whole practice of it because I think it's overly opportunistic and unfairly and disproportionately benefits lawyers in all of this. So perhaps it's a personal prejudice that I should work really hard to get over. But when I see that, you know, putative class actions have been filed, I always, come to it with a narrower mind than what I should. So I'm just here to confess that. Maybe that's it. That's all.
Right. I'm glad you brought up the Wiretap Act because, again, sort of analogizing this to what ISPs can do with your data, one of the arguments posited for, oh, it's okay that the FCC is not going to more tightly regulate what ISPs can do with your data is that there are these various and sundry other lawsuits that could be brought, and one of them could be wiretapping like this one. So it seems like this is a good example of some creative lawyers trying to drive a truck through a hole in a privacy policy or lack of privacy communication. And we'll have to see where it goes. Matt, I'm wondering, you know, maybe as our youngster on the show or relative youngster on the show, I'm wondering, am I just generationally so far removed from what expectations are or should be about devices that I was sort of stunned that Bose has a business model that involves chronicling what's being played through its headphones and leveraging that data? Is that something that you and those of your generation are just coming to expect?
I've sort of seen the backside of the industry, so I'm not so surprised. I think that other people would be surprised. Mm-hmm. you know, but I think going back to the article, the thing that struck me is that it didn't even go into whether you could contract around these things. And it seemed like the lawyer was trying to make the argument that this was a strict liability claim, which you couldn't opt out around or mm-hmm. opt in or opt out or contract for. So I just can't see the court looking at this and saying, because that would turn over the way, you know, we couldn't transfer information between our phone and our computer. Like all of that would theoretically be violating the Wiretap Act. Mm-hmm. So I just based on the article, again, I didn't read it. But yeah, I think that there is a growing, maybe a growing understanding, especially with people who are connected with tech, that you've got to work to not have your data sold. That is the way, yeah, maybe that's the way the world is. But I human interaction is sometimes hard for me, so who knows?
We're sorry. We'll bring you out of your shell here, Matt.
Thanks.
Mike, our pleasure. Mike, what do you think about creepy listening headphones and the likelihood of success on this suit?
Yeah, so I did take a quick spin through the complaint, and it struck me. I think it's a very well put together complaint. You know, I wonder if this is just an instance of, again, another in a string of instances that we've witnessed and talked about lately of maybe companies not fully appreciating and thinking through all the consequences. The complaint itself references how you can learn a lot from people's music selections as to who they are and how old they are, but also their podcast listening habits was something that was called out specifically, that you can learn a lot about someone's attitudes and, again, kind of their demographic information by, you know, having access to their playlists. So, you know, it strikes me as they've got something here really well put together. I don't know about the wiretapping claim because I don't know much about it. But if it's about intercepting a wire communication, I mean, does this qualify as a communication? I just don't know. But there's also some privacy state law claims and some other claims that have been added. So it's definitely one for us to keep on our watch list.
Yeah, definitely. I think it'll be a case that will become more and more interesting as they do discovery and there more and more facts come out. If there's a summary judgment motion at some point, and we determine exactly, you know, how the technology is working and how that fits within the rubric of the Wiretap Act, that'll shed a lot of light on what's going on here. Let us, since we're talking about
Last thing we should mention is that this is venued in the same location where the WeVibe lawsuit was filed. So
he's coming back to that.
That's right. So, you know, as Eastern District of Texas seems to be a venue for one kind of lawsuit, this is a venue for devices recording your activity and phoning home that maybe you did not expect. Could be worse. All right. Or maybe it couldn't.
We're not going to start the puns on that one. Are
we? No, we're not. Not intentionally anyway. Let us move on then, since we're on this subject of whether you can contract around things like activities that would otherwise violate wiretap laws. Evan, you had a really interesting blog post recently about enforcing an online seller's terms and conditions, and in Florida now it can be that things get a little fast and loose in Florida, but you'll have to tell us if that's what happened in this case. In Florida, those terms were found not to be enforceable. And so let's talk for a moment about terms of service. Was this just the problem that Eric Goldman likes to characterize as click wrap versus browse wrap? One is a contract and one is just not a contract. There's no discussion about it. Was that where this came to ground, this case?
I think so. And, you know, yeah. I I would not adopt such a bright line dichotomy that if indeed that's what Professor Goldman has says, that, you know, browser app agreements are never contracts. And I think he would know that that's not necessarily true, because there is case law holding certain browser app agreements enforceable. One of them coming from here in Illinois, the Hubbard versus Dell case from 2005 held that a browser app agreement is enforceable. So this one was along those lines. And just, you know,
before,
to make sure that
before you go on and jump into this case, let's explain for people who don't know the difference. I mean, we're constantly presented with agreements and documentation online. Sometimes we have to click. Other times we just know there's a link there that says privacy policy or terms of service. And we just know it's there. What's the difference, and why should it make a difference?
Right. This is a question about, you know, what contract, you know, it governs the legal relationship between provider and user, whether that be, you know, the visitor to a website or the one downloading an application or signing up for some kind of subscription. You know, what kind of electronic agreement has been entered into? And just a little bit of historical nuance, since we're sort of on a retro theme. I mean, the idea of a click wrap agreement is one where you actually have to click the button that says, I accept the terms of services. And, you know, and technologically the site is set up where you can't move on to the next phase of the transaction unless you've actually clicked on that or checked or, you know, click the box or check the button or something like that. Browser app is where it's just at the bottom and you see it there, but you don't necessarily have to do anything affirmatively to indicate your assent to the terms. But it comes back historically from a play on the concept of shrink wrap, which was you know, the actual plastic wrap that would go around boxes of floppy disks or compact disks or whatever, where you'd actually, you know, imagine that having to acquire software on tangible physical media. So the essential issue in all of this is one that really is not unique to internet law or online transactions or e-commerce or what have you. It all has to come down to indications of whether or not the parties have a meeting of the minds, whether or not there is evidence of mutual assent to these things. So they're very factual driven, these kinds of cases that ascertain whether or not an online agreement is enforceable. And essentially it rises and falls on whether there's sufficient evidence to show that the user who is usually the one who's being tasked with abiding by the terms that he or she purportedly agreed to, whether or not they actually agreed to those things. And the browser app agreements generally are less likely to be found enforceable because there's not the evidence available to show that the user actually assented to those terms. It's much harder, difficult. It's much more harder. Much more difficult. It's harder.
Much more harder.
Easy for you to say, right? it's easier to, what am I trying to say? Good grief. It's easier to come up with evidence that there's been mutual assent if there's that click there. So this case in Florida was one where there was a browser app agreement. There were links at the bottom of the page and you could, I forget what it was, sign up for a service or download an application or something without having actually seen the link to the purported agreement at the bottom of the page. And so I think in this case, the court held that the defendant did not, no, yeah, that the plaintiff did not have to arbitrate his claim against the defendant. So that's how that the issue is whether or not the arbitration clause in the terms was enforceable, and the court held that that arbitration clause did not apply because there was no agreement ever entered into in the first place.
Right. So in Florida here, can you explain what happened?
Well, just essentially that, I forget the actual facts. It was some kind of claim against, I think it was a provider it might have been even like a personal injury case. I think it was some vitamin supplements. I should have read it, since I wrote it. Was that what it was?
Yep.
And it had to do with whether there was going to be arbitration of this this claim. And the court held that it was fine for it to for the matter to be heard in court because the arbitration clause was not enforceable. So
right.
That's it.
Right. So that, I think when Professor Goldman says there's one thing that's a contract and one thing that's another, even though there are cases out there that might have gone the other way, here. I think he does that more for, and I hate to put thoughts in his head or words in his mouth, but for practical advice to those drafting these agreements, that if you want it to be enforceable, you better make it a click wrap, because there's just way too much uncertainty about the whole browse wrap scenario. Mike, do you think that this is a distinction that is pretty meaningless these days? Whether you're clicking on something or not, no one is reading the terms, right?
I think there's a fairly broad consensus that a lot of people don't read the terms when you click through it. I mean, what this really comes down to ultimately, whether you read the terms or not, it's whether you've manifested your assent, whether these terms are conspicuous enough for you to be able to signify that you agree to them, whether you've read them or not. And I haven't read the case. I did read Evan's blog post, but I think ultimately that's probably where the court was saying, look, there just wasn't sufficient enough assent or evidence of assent. Is that right, Evan? So there just wasn't an agreement.
Yep. Yeah. Because you could enter into the transaction without scrolling down to the bottom of the page where the link would be, which is different than the Illinois case, the Hubbard versus Dell case from 2005, where the language of the court said anybody with common sense, and I think the court actually did use the term common sense, you know, would know that this blue text that's underlined here is a link that you click on. And if you click on it, you expect to find more information. So there was not that indicator that the user would know that they were expected to be bound by these terms that were linked to at the bottom.
Right. So we're not the only people paying attention to these issues. There are lots of people out there paying attention to these issues and how to deal with the fact that people don't read and that manifesting assent may not mean that you really understand what you're assenting to. Jamie Dimon is the CEO of JP Morgan, and he had, you know, sort of a thunderous talk that he gave to a crowd of MBA students at a joint town hall put on by JP Morgan and Yahoo Finance, where he demonstrated, you know, and these are pretty sophisticated people, right? MBA students. He demonstrated how little they knew about what they had agreed to in agreements with companies like Mint, for example, anything where your financial information is being used. And he pointed out to them that they perhaps had given their bank passcodes away without expressly realizing that that had been done. His solution is in line with many folks in sort of the just-in-time privacy user interface sphere of influence or philosophy that you know, these agreements that we're talking about, where there's a whole bunch of text that you've got to wade through and you really need a team of lawyers to understand all the ramifications of it, because a team of lawyers drafted it with the drafter's interests in mind. He says, the CEO of JP Morgan says, I want to build something that's really good for the customer. And you say, I love that. I control my data, and you give me a way to turn it on or off. So he seems to be going more toward, he says, eventually you should be able to go on your mobile, look at the data that's being shared and decide what to share, how to share it, when to share it, so that you can turn it off. So more of a just-in-time notification and gathering assent that way. Matt, are you comfortable or confident that business in general is moving in the direction that Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan wants it to?
I think that the more competitive the industry is, and I think that banking is one of those things where they're putting a lot of money into the customer acquisition. They're seeing long-term benefits from that. I think that industries like that, kind of like with any hot social issue, they're going to respond. So I think that this is enlightened self-interest on his part, and I think this is great. I'm less, you know, I think that the ISPs is a different issue, and because they're not a competitive industry, I don't think they'll respond this way. But to the extent that companies are hearing that this is something that people are worried about, I think this is a wonderful development.
All right, Mike Keyes, any thoughts before we move on?
No, I totally agree with that. Nothing insightful to add from this vantage point.
All right. Well, this isn't as good as our prior MCLE passphrase, I'm afraid. But it's going to be just in time notices is our second phrase for the show. If you're listening for MCLE or other professional credit, in keeping with our theme of things being a little retro and examining things through that lens, we're going to look next at what the internet would have been like or was like in the absence of protections put in place to enable third-party participants on sites, users of sites, to do bad things without triggering liability for the site owner itself. So we have this, again, we've been talking about Professor Goldman a lot on the show today, and this is something Professor Eric Goldman at Santa Clara University pays maybe more attention to than just about anyone else in the world. So if you're interested in the the safe harbor protections that exist for website owners, of course, we have safe harbors under the DMCA, and we also have safe harbors under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And that's what Professor Goldman pays a lot of attention to. And it seems as though, and if you follow along with his technology and marketing law blog, you'll see why I say it seems as though Section 230 and the protections that it gives people like YouTube or people like you, if you're a blogger who has comments on your site, then you know that you don't want to be held responsible for every single bad thing that your commenters may do. You know, commenters can be notoriously bad. And whether you're using Yelp or YouTube or whatever interactive service is available out there, Facebook, the social web in general wouldn't exist in the robust way that it does today if it weren't for this Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that protects websites from lawsuits in most instances with some limited exceptions that relate to the activities of users on websites. So we have a couple of developments, and Professor Goldman follows many, that I just wanted to highlight and toss out there for discussion. Number one, it seems like there could be congressional action that either reins in Section 230 or enacts other provisions that amend it. What people don't want to see is websites being able to enable bad behavior and have no accountability. So it seems like there's a movement afoot in Washington to rein that in. There is an act that is not yet law, but it's called, the draft bill is called the No Immunity for Sex Traffickers Act, Sex Traffickers Online Act of 2017, which really doesn't sound like it should have anything to do with whether you're liable for the commenters on your blog site or not, or whether YouTube is liable for the nasty comments on a video. But it does, because what this act would do is amend Section 230 in various ways in an attempt to curtail sexual exploitation of children or sex trafficking of children, et cetera. So it's got really good goals, but you have to be careful what is done in pursuit of those good goals. Evan, are you worried about this one?
Worry may be a little bit too strong of a term, but it definitely is one to pay attention to, because it does certainly seek to narrow the immunity to online service providers that Section 230 affords. My concern would arise from those situations where the law enforcement might try to hold let's say, a hosting company, liable for the idiocy of its users engaging in child sex trafficking through the service. And it tries to tack liability on, whether it be law enforcement trying to tack on criminal liability to that, or private plaintiffs trying to tack on civil liability to that, in those situations where the host could not reasonably have known about the conduct there. And mm-hmm. it's not clear from the language of the proposed it's not clear what the effect of the language here that's being proposed to Section 230 would have to do on the level of knowledge that's there. But if we were to assume that it just takes away Section 230 immunity, we would be left with sort of the traditional framework for secondary liability, which sort of in the habit of thinking of Section 230 in terms of like defamation liability. And the textbook example that you use to, or that one uses to illustrate this is, you know, a bookstore, for example. If it has reason to know that there's a defamatory book on its shelves, it can be held liable for that defamation in addition to the author of that book. Whereas even if the ISP knows that there's a defamatory there's defamatory content on a web page, even if it knows, it's not liable for that. So we're, because it introduces this uncertainty as to the level of protection there, it's going to open up more criminal prosecutions. It's going to invite more plaintiffs' lawsuits. And really, I'm not saying anything here that Professor Goldman's not saying in the article. And the effect of that is going to be, there's going to be a chill on investment potentially on the infrastructure of the internet, which Section 230 was able to foster because it was enacted in 1996, I believe. And obviously seen robust investment in the internet infrastructure because investors aren't afraid that they're going to be held liable for third party content in most situations here. So I guess the to bring it into focus, what I see as a better solution here, because clearly I don't think anybody is so heartless as to say that doing what's necessary to curb sex trafficking online, particularly sex trafficking of children, nobody is so heartless to say is that's not an important issue that ought to be addressed. Backpage having been taken out of this service notwithstanding. What seems to me like might be a better framework here is more like the DMCA, where a provider will be granted protection from liability if it responds expeditiously to take down particular content that it's made aware of that might be something to do with the child's sex trafficking content, rather than just saying there's no immunity whatsoever, whether you knew about it or not, and have this real gray area where you take away Section 230 immunity. You instead put some kind of framework here where there's an incentive for providers to take this content down if they've been made aware of it, just like there is an incentive to take down infringing content under the DMCA if you're made aware of it. We can't forget that it's not a violation of the law to not respond to a DMCA request. It is a violation of the law, however, if you are later found to have infringed copyright, either secondarily or directly, and you lose an affirmative defense if you don't act expeditiously. It seems like that would be a better model here for this. I don't know what you think.
Right. I think that you've raised something really interesting about the parallels between the safe harbor provided by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And we've been talking about the DMCA here, too, even though we sort of moved off of copyright issues, because the DMCA also provides a safe harbor that protects companies against here the infringement of users that it has no control over. That's something that's specifically carved out of Section 230 and dealt with instead in the DMCA. So they both have these safe harbors that make the web work. But on the Communications Decency Act front, there's a definite... It comes from the name of the act and the intention of the act when it was enacted, even though most of it no longer is in effect, but this provision is, that part of the intent of that statute was to have a civilizing impact, and that some degree of moderation, control of what's going on your site is not going to take that safe harbor away from you, as long as you're not actively editorializing, changing, participating in what the users are doing. And I guess we have a new case out of the Ninth Circuit that wants to take a different direction when it comes to the DMCA. The case is called Mavericks, M-A-V-R-I-X, Photographs versus LiveJournal, a Ninth Circuit opinion that just came out. Actually, this is not an opinion, is it? This is an appeal that the case will hear. We're looking at the appellate brief from an Ars Technica case. So we don't have an opinion, do we? Did you look at this, Mike?
I don't think so. I don't think we have an opinion.
This is an opinion. So this did actually come before the court and was decided. Sorry for my uncertainty there. But now I know I'm looking at not a brief and an actual opinion.
And I have no responsibility. You're the ones that are in the Ninth Circuit. I'm just here.
That's right. That's right.
They don't let me in any circuit, so I take.
You're
no
there in a circuit that gets well, less.
Matt and I have the seventh down pat here, so we'll leave you crazy folks out there in the ninth to do whatever.
This Mavericks decision seems to be going a different direction. And the EFF is quite concerned about it because where under Section 230, you would have some ability to, you know, delete and moderate and maintain that civil degree of conduct without giving away your safe harbor and becoming basically the author of the content that's at issue. This case is coming down on the fact on the side that moderation using voluntary moderators could actually do away with the safe harbor, not under Section 230, but under the DMCA. Really interesting decision, one that obviously I need to spend more time looking at and grokking. I'm just picking it up off of Ars Technica at the moment. But it seems to be departing from the jurisprudence that we have that gives these really important protections to websites. And the EFF thinks it's of great concern. What do you think, Mike?
So I haven't read the case. I think this is a fiendishly complex area. You know, the whole, as I understand it, the motivation behind this bill that's been introduced is based on everything that happened with Backpage, as Evan, I think you were mentioning. There was a Senate report that came out in January of this year. They had subpoenaed a bunch of documents and records and were able to kind of take a look at what Backpage was doing. And, you know, according to the Senate report, Backpage, the employees associated with that service were providing quite a bit of editorializing with respect to these ads that were clearly for purposes of prostitution and I guess maybe some instances of sex trafficking. So I think the Senate was rightfully very concerned about this practice, wants to stamp it out, and views, you know, an amendment to 230 as being one arrow in the quiver to take care of this problem. I don't have a good sense for. I mean, obviously, that's a very laudable goal and something that everybody should applaud. You know, I know Professor Goldman is taking a dim view of this bill and saying that, well, it could curb a lot of free speech and otherwise protected activity and so on and so forth. At least I understand that to be his argument. I'm not sure what the instances of that are. I mean, as I understand the proposal, it would be to eliminate Section 230 immunity from state laws that deal with sexual exploitation and sex trafficking of children. So it seems, at least in that respect, that we're talking about a fairly narrow exception here. I'm just not. I don't have a good sense, as I mentioned, as to how is this going to necessarily adversely affect otherwise protected conduct or activity that we should be concerned about. I don't know.
Well, we need to get Professor Goldman on the show to explain in more detail. what he's concerned about with the No Immunity for Sex Traffickers Online Act of 2017, should it pass. And we definitely need to keep an eye on this Mavericks decision and see if sites who use moderators are in jeopardy of losing their DMCA protection when it comes to copyright claims against them.
Matt, you wanted to say something earlier. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Evan. I'll jump in after you.
Well, what I was just going to say, I'm surprised that this whole issue of, you know, what role the moderators have when it comes to these protections, whether it be DMCA safe harbor or Section 230 immunity. I'm surprised that that issue hasn't come up more often, because I think of it, and I don't know if this is accurate, I don't know if this is how the cases treat this, but it seems to fall under principles of agency. You know, if the moderators are actually going in there and doing stuff and making changes and doing things that fall outside of the or even more than the traditional editorial functions, like when it comes to actually generating content, it seems like that ought to be an area where there's a lot of litigation over this stuff. And maybe there's more than what I've been aware of, but given the development of online communities and community moderation, you know, again, to bring up Reddit again, you know, where the moderators play such an important role, it's mm-hmm. just surprising to me that that hasn't come up more often. That's all I just want to sort of make that comment. I really want to hear what you have to say, Matt. Go ahead.
So I think this is actually consistent. The ruling was actually consistent with the Amazon and Perfect 10 ruling, which dealt with originally whether YouTube was fell under the DMCA. I can't remember the case specifics, but there was knowledge that there was a certain percentage of copyright infringement going on the website. And what the court ruled, though, is that the specific there was not specific knowledge of that. And so what YouTube has done in the past since then is that they've put in trackers for whether there's copyright infringement, but they've strategically done that after the content is loaded, because the logic of the Perfect 10 case says that if you're judging the content before it's put on the website, then you fall outside of 230. But if you're judging it afterwards, then you have the protection. So I actually think that although
You just said 230. Did you mean the DMCA?
Yes, I meant the DMCA. Sorry. I'm getting these words straight eventually.
I know. It's like it's those safe harbors are both looking farther and farther away.
Yeah. So I think it's consistent with that. And I think that this is a problem. We talked about it in class about whether, you know, when Facebook was trying to deal with fake news about the section of their content that they were actually editing for whether it's fake news. Our professor, Stephen Yelderman, said that section probably would have fallen outside of Fair Harbor protection. Yeah. And I know that our copyright book will include this case next year.
Alrighty. Good. We will continue to keep an eye on it and on the availability of safe harbors under both Section 230 and the DMCA. It's just interesting that both of them have had recent batches of cases, and now in particular this case in this Mavericks case in the Ninth Circuit for the DMCA, where the participation of the site becomes problematic and may deprive them of the protections that are available to them and that have made the web hum along for quite some time now. This has been, as you said, a fiendishly complicated legal discussion, Mike, and we probably need a little palate cleanser as we go into our concluding material of the show. And we've got a good one for you. We present to you, without further ado, our animal selfie of the week. We have chimpanzees this time around, not a macaque, but a chimpanzee, but a very similar situation to Naruto the macaque, in that what happened here was a journalist who was covering the Sweetwater's chimpanzee sanctuary in, oh goodness, I'm going to butcher this, Laikipia, Kenya, and had a 360-degree camera that he was employing on behalf of the New York Times 360 video site, the Daily 360. He was filming these chimps, and you know what happened. The chimps got a hold of the camera. Ironically enough, it's a GorillaPod stand as well, and began filming themselves. And, yep, you know, who knows if they knew they were filming themselves, but that is what happened. The chimps directed the video footage, and they did so for more than 25 minutes, apparently. They just were not going to give back that camera, had a good old time with it, gave the New York Times some good footage of themselves. And then the, I'm not sure if it was the camera person or one of the crew came up with the brilliant idea of swapping a Fanta for the camera. And so the Times could get its camera back. We have not had word that PETA has gotten involved in this yet to try and see if the footage here that the Times is using to as part of its 360-degree video site, the Daily 360, if some of those proceeds should be set aside for habitat for the chimpanzees or otherwise. This is what PETA did in the Naruto the macaque case. But did not have success with. Yes, Evan.
I wonder if Bill O'Reilly covered the Naruto case. Because he was like, what kind of animal was Naruto?
Go on. All right.
I'm having another Beavis moment. I'm sorry.
You had a little Beavis moment. Yes. It's always good to have a monkey selfie at the end of a show, and I was happy to turn one up for this week. Our tip of the week comes to you from Wired, and it's a really good checklist of stuff. I guess our tip for you is to think about what you're going to do with your data when you exit your job. Now, what Wired has gone and done is take that a step further and given you a really nice checklist of things, not just to think about, but to do and how to do them, all along saying that, for example, if you're saving off things that you don't want to lose when you're leaving your job, you have to make sure that you're not saving confidential information that you're not supposed to have when you leave your job. You have to pay close attention to, you know, your policies and procedures manual and all of the things that constrain you as an employee as far as taking data out of the company. But if it's, you know, your own information that your company does not have proprietary rights to, then you should definitely go down this checklist, which involves backing up data that is on your work issued device that you might need access to when you're gone, making sure your USB slots have been emptied. Did you leave your USB drive or a cable in there? How to shut down your email and make sure that you've done it the right way. Wiping the device if that's something that you can do that you actually have access to do or are allowed to do. And if you don't have permission to do that, they give the very good point that you should get, you know, before you're out the door, get the IT department involved and go through this whole checklist with them and decide, you know, what's best for you and the company as you're leaving. So definitely a good thing to bear in mind so that you're not left without information that you need when you leave your job, and bear in mind that your employer has rights to stuff that you do when you're with them as well. So our resource of the week continues our theme of, with an homage to Stephen Colbert, Know an ISP. Our ISP this week that we looked at was Xfinity and Comcast, another one of these merged ones. And just like with our prior discussion, it's sometimes hard to know, you know, if you come in as we discussed this before in the context of Time Warner and Spectrum. Here we have Xfinity and Comcast, and you might have been a customer of one and not be sure which policies apply to you. So that problem seems to persist. I'm discerning some themes as I go through many of these privacy policies. The one that did definitely carry over here is there's not good demarcation between what policy applies to you. If you're an Xfinity customer, a Comcast customer, some of the language says one company or the other, one brand name or the other, but seems to apply to everyone. And the good thing to bear in mind with that is if there's confusion in these documents because of these mergers and people just haven't cleaned things up enough to make it clear, one good principle to note of contract interpretation is if the confusion is caused by the drafter of the documents, here the cable company itself, it's putting these things out there, if it harms the consumers, it's going to be construed against the cable company since they drafted the language and caused the confusion. That's how it should go anyway. So even if you can't figure out which policy applies to you, know that if you're doing your best, it should work in your favor. Second thing, another recurring theme is there are different policies for the web side of the company. They Xfinity.com/privacy is where you're going to find the privacy policy that applies to its web presence. But if you are a cable video, high-speed internet, phone and communications and home securities services customer, any of those services, then you're going to go to a different place for your privacy policy that applies to all of those. And again, we're going to, since some of these links can be long, we're going to put them into our discussion points, and you can find all these after the show if you go there. What to tell you about what I learned here? You have to be logged in. This seems to be another common theme. If you're going to log in to manage your privacy settings for your cable service, your high-speed internet service, once you've logged into your account, you go to the account page for you, and there's a tiny, tiny link. I think we have a picture of it somewhere that says Manage Advertising Preferences at that link. When you click that, you will find a screen that allows you to opt out of advertising advertising that's geared to your activity using the services. If you do that, you will not receive advertising based on your activity data. Again, just to further confuse things, when you pull up that window, it states that despite the fact that you went to the right policy and you're following all the right instructions, it states that it is for cable video customers and says nothing about high-speed internet, phone and communications, home security service, the other things. But again, I think those confusions are going to be resolved in your favor if push comes to shove. If you opt out, your advertising will not, they're going to continue to advertise to you, and they don't say that they're not going to continue to collect your activity data. What they say is that the advertising you receive will not be based on that activity data. Whether or not you opt out, interestingly, Comcast/Xfinity says it will not give your name or other identifying information to an advertiser without your express consent. I think they're violating the Tanya Foresight rule there by saying they will not give identifying information to an advertiser without your express consent. That's a loaded term and can mean many things these days, and can give rise to lawsuits. So there's a tip for Comcast and Xfinity that they should listen to good privacy lawyers and maybe change the way that they're presenting that. There is then a completely separate page that you need to find and opt out there for email marketing. So if they have your email address and you don't want to be marketed to that way, you're going to have to take separate steps to do that. And then finally, remember we talked on previous shows where we've been featuring these ISP privacy policies about CPNI, that stands for Customer Proprietary Network Information. Every one of the ones we've looked at up until now gives you a link where you can do that online. Comcast and Xfinity do not. This is the information where one division of the company can use your personally identifiable information, not your activity data, to market, say, internet services to you if you're a cable company, that kind, or if you're a cable customer, that kind of thing. If you want to opt out of that with Xfinity or Comcast, you have to call 1-800-XFINITY to accomplish that. That's the only way to do it. And the other interesting thing about that CPNI data is they tell you that they may also combine that data, personally identifiable information, which we collect as described in this notice, blah, 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 with personally identifiable information obtained from third parties for the purpose of creating an enhanced database or business records. We may use this database and these business records for marketing, advertising, and other activities related to our cable service and other services. We also maintain records of research concerning subscriber satisfaction, et cetera, et cetera. So they are not just using their own information, they're saying that it's you're agreeing to their combining their whatever information they know about you with more personally identifiable information obtained from third parties, and that they're going to do that for marketing, advertising, and other activities, presumably only their own, that they're not going to use that enhanced database they're talking about here to sell to other parties, because they have said elsewhere, we will not give your name or other identifying information to an advertiser without your express consent. So what I come away from this with is a good plaintiff's lawyer could make a lot out of this. And number two, if you want to exercise your opt-outs, we have links to the precise pages at Xfinity and Comcast where you can do so if you look them up in our discussion points. So we will continue
can
on.
Can you go through that again?
Sorry?
Can you?
Yeah, no. Absolutely, 100% no. Okay. What I've been doing is putting together a little Facebook post with screen grabs and links. So I'll do that again, and I will put that link in our discussion points too, so that it's all in one place. And again, I mean, this is starting. We've got a retro theme to the show today. Is all this starting to feel a bit retro? Do people not need us to keep going through ISP privacy policies? Is this issue sort of come and gone? I mean, I think people are still concerned about it, and there are a lot of ISPs out there. What do you think, Mike? Should we stop kicking this dead bull?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it sounds like you're maybe on the horns of a dilemma as to whether you want to keep doing it, but no, I think it's terrific.
All right, good.
And good to hear about all these inconsistencies and all these potential issues. I think it's very important.
All right, I'll keep going. You know, and
so
people
charge ahead.
Charging ahead. I'm steering in that direction. People do start sending it. I'm going through most of the majors, as you can see. But if you have other ISPs you'd like us to take a look at, do send them in. You can reach me. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. Reach out to any of us and let us know what's on your mind, what you'd like to see us cover on the show, guests you'd like to have us invite. Of course, Evan, you can reach by hitting him up at internetcases.com, where he continues to write a really, really excellent blog. Evan, what else is going on with you these days? Catch us up.
Oh, just, you know, living the life of a rock star. That's it. Just, you know, going on tour later this year, showing off some of my master services agreements to people. So. That's it. No, life is good, you know, here in Chicago, keeping busy, you know, always interested to see how the technology scene is developing in Chicago. A lot of innovation, a lot of funding going on here. So Chicago is a great place to be practicing technology law. Great clients. It's a great climate here. So other than that, life is good. I've been at this firm now, Mutch Shellest, for about 2.5 years. So figuring out how to hit on all cylinders here. So great colleagues, great practice. Really liking that as well. And then, you know, there's the occasional highlight on a Friday afternoon of coming back to Twill. Always good to talk with you. And, you know, this has been a great conversation. Really enjoyed it a lot. Matt, nice to meet you. Just across the state line over there in Indiana. If you're ever in town, give me a call and drop a line.
We'll
grab coffee or something. And Mike, good to talk with you again. And Denise, I'm grateful for the chance to come back. Thank you very much.
I'm so grateful that you did. And I'm grateful too to my wonderful co-hosts, Mike and Matt. Thanks so much for joining us this week, guys. And thank you so much for joining us. Whether you've watched this show live or picked it up on your own time after the fact, we're thrilled that you watch the show, however you do. We do record live at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC every Friday. If you head on over to twit.tv, that's where you're going to find us doing the live thing. But if you can't do that, don't worry. Head over to twit.tv/twill and you'll find our whole archive of shows. It's fun to get retro with it and go back and see that the issues that we were talking about, you know, 10 years ago now are still many of them current or how they've evolved. You know, I'm not suggesting that you're required to go back and listen to all our old shows, but they are there for you should you wish to do so. Or if there's a particular issue that you want to drill deeper on, odds are we may have covered it on the show. We've been here for quite some time and we will continue to do what we're doing. We love interacting with you and talking about these issues every week. We hope you will join us next week for This Week in Law. And until then, please take care.
Right on.